Okay, so last lecture we had a look at the core functionality of the network layer, and that was in getting packets from host to host, so from machine to machine, over multiple hops, over multiple network connections. And so we looked at some, and the key issue in doing so is how do you decide the path? And we saw that it was desirable that we have a distributed algorithm to do this, and we looked at several options. Distance vector routing and link state routing, and discuss what were the pros and cons of each and where they might be used. So this lecture, what we're going to do is we're going to look at some aspects of the internet, and namely what protocols are associated with the internet. As I've said before, the glue that holds the internet together is IP, so the internet protocol, and we'll say a few words about that, mainly the sort of complications of addressing within IP. And again, we assume that we are running the TCP/IP protocol stack. And so IP will get you host to host. We'll then look at getting you process to process. So if you look at the diagram at the bottom, you see you have applications. They use sockets to request internet services, essentially, or to request the networking services. We have two possibilities. You can have sort of an in-order data stream delivery, or you can have a best effort packet delivery service, and that will run on top of IP. And we'll have a look at some of the major mechanisms that are used, in particular with TCP, to provide the service it does, and also how it sort of improves the quality of service of the network in general. Okay, and so the internet and the protocols associated with it was designed with this idea of openness in mind. So open design, open implementation, open standardization. And so the famous quote from David Clark was, "We reject kings, presidents, and voting. We believe in rough consensus and running code." Okay, so this was very much a collaborative effort, and they resisted the idea that any one entity should be in control, and arguably that it was the key to the success, that sort of anybody could join in. Okay, so in addition to openness, we want independence, and so we don't want, we want to now sort of not be tied to a specific physical architecture. And so, again, all we're going to assume is that we can sort of achieve point-to-point connectivity from the physical architecture. And we need to, and it needed to be designed in such a way that it was scalable, and in that it was quite successful, as we can see by the sort of this continuing growth. Okay, the protocols have evolved over time, but a lot of the core remains, at least theoretically, quite similar. One IP was again designed as a connectionless, to provide a sort of a connectionless service, and as we discussed with InServe and DiffServe, the idea of connections does cause concerns within the IP, the internet community, but it also allows us to provide for more quality of service guarantees than we can without connections. And you know, as we observed, if you truly want to provide any quality of service guarantees to sort of individual applications, then you are going to have to implement admission control and resource reservation. Okay. But we're going to look, you know, again, we've mentioned that before. We're not going to sort of pursue it here. Okay, so the original intention of the internet was to provide robust transfer of computer-to-computer data over long distances. And so the paradigm for data transfer was a best effort service. There were no, the types of transfer that were envisaged at the time didn't have any real-time data requirements as we would understand them today, so nobody had pondered streaming videos over the internet, over this network. It was more, again, communicating with mainframes, transferring files, sending sort of control-type messages. Okay. Things have changed, and you know, applications have evolved again to require possibly more quality of service than you can extract from best effort, but it's left to the endpoints to deal with that and to adapt to the network conditions as they may. If you look at Kuros and Ross, for instance, they'll have a whole section discussing real-time applications and how real-time applications can run over these best effort services. Okay. And we've discussed previously why we might want to this connectionless packet switching versus circuit switching. If the data that you're sending is bursty, then this can it can be sent in this fashion with no setup and no blocking. Okay, it allows for flexibility and transmission rates. So usually if you're having to make reservations, you're fitting yourself into the chunks of amounts of resources that are provided within the circuit switches. Okay, there's no predetermined path. So if something goes wrong along one path, you just work around and find another available path. And at the time, and for the type of traffic that was being was being produced, this made more efficient use of the network resources. So we, you know, the ideas of statistical multiplexing and the ability to queue worked better than sort of, again, reserving fixed amounts of resources over a path. Okay. So, the Internet Protocol dealt with sort of the data transport end to end, and so it assumed that you had some point-to-point connectivity, but again, was not in the business of prescribing how that connectivity was achieved. So to tie it all together, again, we could do that at the network layer through the IP protocol, and we that protocol gave us two things. It gave us a unified addressing scheme, so sort of worldwide we could determine what the sort of physical the address of the, we could denote physical machines sort of uniformly, and of course it also suggested how the protocol, the routing protocol, should work. So the idea of having decisions based locally on that, on the destination IP address. Okay. And allowing, again, a best effort service machine to machine. So the transport layer protocol then was an interface between, again, getting data machine to machine, now getting data process to process, where you had processes running on the different machines. And so built upon this best effort service was either essentially just a forwarding mechanism in UDP or TCP, which allowed for a connection-oriented service, so we could connect our end processes and have data streams between the end processes, but again, built over this connectionless network service. Okay, and then there were also a number of basic protocols specified, which would run over one or the other of these transport services, typically TCP, although in a few cases where you're doing short messaging only, like DNS, UDP. So beyond the sort of details of how routing is achieved, we have the idea of addressing, and a standardized header in encompassing all of the information that we need in order to achieve network routing. Okay. So there have been many versions of the IP protocol, and the one that is sort of most common is the IPv4. And here we see the IPv4 header. And so again, this is all the information that we're going to need to move our data through the internet. And so we have our IP addresses. We need one for the source and one for the destination. And then you can think that you know, again, your routing would be based on an examination of the destination protocol. Destination address. We have an indication, starting at the top, we have an indication of the version. And so for IPv4, that's 4. We have an indication of the header length. We need this because the options can be a variable length and are sort of left in there to allow for, again, future possibilities and future whatever you need, whatever future routing policies might need. We have a field for service type, and at this point that's split into an indication of what sort of service you might want. And so, for instance, if you have a voice over IP stream, you might want to indicate that you have streaming data. And also, possibly, it also encompasses congestion notification. You have an indication of the total length of the packet now, so not just the header, but the packet. You have a number of fields that have to do with fragmentation, and so the packet starts out at a certain length, but it's possible that the networks that are carrying the packet, so the point-to-point connections, may not handle that particular length. So if not, the packet will be split up into multiple packets to be reintegrated later. And in that case, you have an identification field that indicates that all the portions belong together, and a fragmentation offset, so that indicates for the payload where the fragmentation, the payload, how you would need to reassemble the data, the payload. Okay, the flags again are used to identify and control the use of fragmentation. Okay. So one of the bits is, for example, with one of the bits, you can indicate that you don't want fragmentation to occur. And if you indicate that and you encounter a link where you can't, that won't handle the frame size, well, then your packet's going to be dropped. Okay, so the time to live is, again, to used to prevent packets from sort of existing forever in the network, being sort of forwarded and forwarded and not getting where they want. So each time each time you forward the packet, you decrease the time to live. Okay, and when it reaches zero, you drop the packet. The protocol bit indicates the IP protocol used. The header checksum will check that, again, the header bits at least are correct. And as we said before, we have our source and destination address. We also have options, which can be used to carry other information to sort of for improved routing services. Okay, so the addresses, the source and destination addresses, are as indicated in the header there, all each 32 bits. And so, and they're each, and that's divided up into 4 bytes. And you, in order to write the address, you put a full stop in between each byte. Okay. And so the addresses carry typically 2 pieces of information. The network that the host identification and the sort of end network that that host is attached to. Okay. And originally, the addresses were divided into classes, of which A, B, and C are network to host. And this was based on sort of, again, how people envisaged the arrangement within the network. And so what we see is that class A has a very small number of networks, each of which can manage a large number of hosts. And then you went down to class C, which would give you a lot of networks with a very... with a relatively small number of hosts. Okay. So a few of the addresses are reserved for sort of control information. And so you have all zeros indicates and the originating host. If your network ID is all zero, then you're indicating a local network. All ones is used to broadcast on a local network, etc. Okay. So the key feature of an IP address is that it has to uniquely identify a physical machine, and so you can't just have people randomly picking their IP addresses. Rather, the allocation is managed at a high level by the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. So it's a nonprofit organization which manages the IP address allocation. Okay. Now, it would be sort of difficult to do that worldwide, so ICANN has sort of subdivided the IP address space and given portions of that space to more local bodies to manage. Okay. So we all know that we don't address as end users anyway, we don't address anything by the IP address, but rather we have sort of URLs, email addresses, etc. And so there has to be, again, a translation service provided that allows end users to be able to use, again, user-understandable names and have those translated into IP addresses. Okay. The translation service is the domain name service, and this domain name service is, again, it's essentially a distributed database. And so it's arranged hierarchically, starting at a root name service and then going to domain name services and below that authoritative name services. So by sort of a series of queries to possibly all of these bodies, we can find our IP address starting with a name. Okay, so in our example, we have user at cs.arizona.edu, and what we're going to need to know is what's the IP address associated with cs.arizona.edu. And in this case, again, we can ask the name server. Now, and we have that IP address returned to us. That IP address is a component in the interface that we'll need to tell TCP who we want to connect to. The other component would be a indication of the program that we wish to connect to. So this IP address gives us the machine. TCP, in order to route the information in the appropriate direction, will give that IP address to the internet protocol for routing purposes. Okay, so the way in which we expect the hierarchical name server to work is that we have a root name server, and it would know, for instance, it might know all of the EDU name servers, so within that it would find the Arizona name server, and so it would, the root would typically return to the user the Arizona name server. You could then query that, and the local name server, you could query that, and that would indicate the CS name server, and the CS name server then would have the actual IP address. Okay. Okay. So once we have our IP address, we use that for the routing. And so typically the way a router is constructed, it will have a number of inputs and a number of outputs and a switch which will connect inputs with outputs. What connections are made is going to be based on the routing protocol decided by the routing CPU. So, an IP packet is going to arrive, encapsulated into the data link frame. The line card is going to perform all the data link layer logic to ensure that the frame has been successfully received. We check to make sure that the IP header has been successfully received, so the information we're getting is valid to act upon. Then we look at the destination address. Assuming that it's not going to a local machine, we look at the routing lookup table to decide where to forward on the packet, and possibly potentially we could use service classes to change the order in which to prioritize the forwarding of the packets. When we forward the packet out, we decrease the time to live field, we recompute the header checksum, which will obviously have changed because of the time to live field, and then send the packet to the appropriate output port. Then the line cards will again package the will package the packet into a frame and transport and then transmit the packet along the link. Okay. Now, some control messages could possibly need to be sent if there are problems with this process. So, Internet Control Message Protocol, ICMP, is used to indicate the sort of do any management required. And so if a packet fails to be forwarded for one reason or another, you can send an ICMP error message back to the back to the sender. Okay. So this is a statistic that we are capable of statistical multiplexing, so if we don't have immediate resources to retransmit our packet, we can buffer our packets. The buffers are a finite length, so if the buffers become full, we have to discard the packets. Okay, so as we said, in addition to sort of the basics of forwarding packets, ICMP allows us to handle any problems that arise in the transmission of packets. Okay. Now, One possible issue is that at some point we need to link our IP addresses to physical machine addresses, so specifically the data link layer address. Okay. So, in terms of a destination, the destination is going to end up on a machine on a local area network. So how do we know the local area network identity of the machine? Okay, and so again, we have to have a protocol to manage this, and we use the address resolution protocol. Okay, and hosts have to, again, maintain a cache with the translation between IP addresses and physical addresses. Again, we don't keep, and that cache information is not kept forever, but for a certain amount of time. If we don't have any information about the destination IP address, then we can query on the local network, and we just ask the machines whether they know a physical address for the destination IP address. And while we're at it, we indicate the sending host's information as well. Okay, just sort of include as much information as possible. If the destination is on the local network, then we get a response with the physical address. And if it's not on the local network, the ARP server will just send its own physical address. If a host doesn't know its own IP address, then it can use a reverse process by which it would broadcast its physical address and ask for a corresponding IP address. Okay, and the ARP server can reply. But the basic idea is just that you have to keep also a translation between, again, local area network addressing, so that we actually know where our physical machine is, and the IP address. Okay. So, returning to then our idea of our IP address, as we said, we had a network part and a host ID part. So this gave us sort of a two-level hierarchy. And so again, that would represent you'd have a network with a bunch of hosts attached. Now within an organization, that may not represent the actual physical reality of the organization. Typically, within an organization, you may have a number of networks which are connected together somehow, and then have each of the networks has their own hosts attached. Okay. So, in terms of the internet, again, that there's not going to be any distinction between the two, but we would like to be able to sort of distinguish between a subnetwork so that we can direct our information to the appropriate portion of the network. Okay, and this can be done through subnetting. Okay. And so with subnetting, we'll begin to have a router that sort of interfaces with the rest of the network and then routes information in the appropriate direction. So, in terms of the external network, the packets destined for any of the hosts will still reach our router, our sort of interface router. Because the addressing for that has not changed, but the router is going to be able then to distinguish between the different subnets within the network, and it is going to do that by taking a portion of the host ID address and using that to distinguish between the different subnets. Okay, so we see in our example here, the network ID is the same, but now instead of having host IDs, having the host ID, we take that host ID and we divide it up into a subnet ID and a host ID. So that allows us within an organization to have more networks with possibly sort of a lesser number of hosts attached. Okay. So in order to it's simple enough to implement this sort of an addressing scheme. We just use what's called masking to pick off the relevant portions of the addressing for each of the subnets. So the extraction of sort of portions of the information is referred to as masking, and it will be done as part of the packet forwarding process. So, you know, if you're looking for a network, you have to pick out the network ID. If you're looking for a host, you have to pick out the host ID. Yeah. Okay. So, masking just means taking a bit-by-bit AND of the IP address and the mask. Okay, so we see in our example, well, just in order to find the network address, again, we're going to pick off the network components, so the first couple of components, and block out the host ID components. And then if we are performing subnetting, then we sort of want to we grab the third field there as well to give us the subnet address. Okay. So they don't. You don't have to. You know, so we've masked a byte at a time. You don't have to. You can mask for any number of bits. Okay. So here we've in the third field we've picked off the two higher bits and used that for our subnet address. In our last example. Okay, so the original allocation of network classes turned out, again, not to be terribly efficient. So, as an example, half of all the class in the 90s, all half of the Class B networks had less than 50 hosts, so they were provisioned for a lot more. So if we think about our idea of subnetting, then there's no real reason that we have to keep within these classes. We could give organizations which are large enough for a Class B address a number of Class C addresses instead. So as long as you give organizations sort of contiguous blocks of addresses, then they could act sort of, again, as sort of in conjunction with as a network ID and host ID. So classless interdomain routing attempts to do this and allocate contiguous blocks of Class C addresses to act sort of like a Class B address, okay, and without having to stick strictly within those boundaries. So, if a company needs 8,000 IP addresses, it could get 32 contiguous blocks of Class C addresses. That gives us a little over 8,000. And if they are contiguous, then the first 19 bits are the same. And so we can use the first 19 bits as the network address and the rest as the host IDs. Okay. And so in order to indicate how many of the bits indicate a network ID, we explicitly share that information. Okay. So we can use this for sort of any block of addresses. Okay. So again, it's a similar idea to the idea to subnetting. With subnetting, we have an idea of one network IP address can be shared among multiple physical networks. With CIDR, we can collapse multiple adjacent IP addresses into one network prefix. Okay, but in both cases, but we still retain this idea of a certain portion of the IP address is indicating network, a certain portion is indicating host, and we just have to keep track of which bit is which. Okay. So, we're almost done with, a very quick discussion of IP addressing. You've probably all heard of IPv6, which is the next generation of IP, and we'll have, again, slightly different addressing format. The driver behind evolving from IPv4 to IPv6 is the limitation on the number of addresses available for IPv4. Okay. So, you're fixed by the 4-byte addressing, 4-byte representation of the address. And so there's a number of ways in which the addresses have been sort of stretched. We saw subnetting in CIDR, and now, again, a lot of times, multiple machines share IP addresses. Okay, and we'll look at that in a sec. But we're still running out of addresses. Pretty much all the IPv4 addresses are allocated, and it's there is a crunch on addresses. Okay. So, also, while there were some issue the quality of service considerations, it was typically not handled within the protocols as implemented, and security was also an issue. So, to sort of fix all of those issues, IPv6 was proposed. Okay, it's not compatible with IPv4, so if you have an IPv4 router, then it's not going to recognize an IPv6 header. It is compatible with TCP and UDP and higher layer protocols. Okay, so again, the proposal for this occurred in the 90s, and it's still slow to be adopted. What are the major features of IPv6? Well, we have a much larger address, and so again, you have 2 to the power of 128, so that, it's again a bit 3.4 times 10 to the 38 addresses available. Okay, so yeah, so there is a statistic on density that would give 16,000 addresses per square meter of the Earth's surface. So that ought to be, enough addresses to go around, even, presumably even in the age of Internet of Things. Okay. So it simplifies the packet header function a bit. And some of those simplifications in general represent sort of improvements in sort of the network delivery services, the underlying links, so physical links over which data is transported. So fragmentation is less of an issue. And in general, we can assume that information that loss occurs much more because of congestion than because of errors. So we can remove checksums for our headers. Okay, so it's going to support it. It has better support for various routing options, and supports per-flow traffic handling and traffic classes. So all of the concepts that we would see in int-serve and diff-serve, which we mentioned earlier, would be explicitly supported in IPv6. And it also supports authentication and security. Okay. So, again, we have a header which has to indicate what version we're using. So, 6, traffic classes and flow labels. So, again, our support, our explicit support for the quality of service routing and networking. Payload length, next header if we need to link packets together, and a hop limit like a time to live. Okay, we then have our larger addresses and the next header actually it indicates if any other information is required within the header. So again, any other protocol information that you want to support. Okay, so in general, everybody agrees that IPv6 is a good idea. But it has been very slow in actually being implemented. So I looked around for a few statistics, and in 2016, roughly 10% of routers were running IPv6. It's predicted that we will have 50% by 2019. Okay, so we'll see if that happens. Why? Mainly because it becomes hard. It's very hard. It's such a fundamental component of the network. It is very hard to sort of replace it, and it doesn't work to sort of just replace it a router at a time, but you sort of have to replace it on a larger scale. Okay, so I included the link to an article which just discusses the issues of, again, why the uptake is so slow. It's always nice to think about sort of non-technical reasons that sometimes things work or don't work. Okay, so as I mentioned before, it is true that we're running out of IPv4 addresses, and so one final common technique is to use what's called a NAT router, and NAT stands for Network Address Translation, and essentially what a NAT router allows you to do is to share addresses amongst multiple users. Okay, so essentially our NAT router is, again, it's providing address translation between IP addresses and sort of multiple devices, and therefore we can, again, share IP addresses amongst multiple devices without having to notify everybody that this is being done, and the devices can change from one ISP to another without the worry, because you know they don't have a specific IP address associated with them, so there's nothing that has to be relinquished when they leave. Okay. And so a final so again, the sharing of IP addresses is sort of useful both from the end user point of view and from the sort of address conservation point of view. You're only assigned an address when you need one. Additionally, the NAT router provides a shield between the device, the sort of user end user devices, and the outside world. So end user devices aren't explicitly addressable by anybody, but you know, any sort of addressing or any attempt to reach the end users has to go through the NAT, and so the NAT can provide security. So what does the NAT do? It when a user the users have essentially dummy source IP addresses, and that the NAT will take care of, and so the NAT will replace the source IP and port number of every outgoing packet with its own IP address and a new port number. So essentially, again, it's providing an interface between the user and the outside network. Okay, the remote client or server will respond using the, well, obviously the provided NAT IP address and new port number. Okay, so the NAT then has to remember the connection between the information it provided and the information that the end user provided, and provided and translate between the two addresses. So when an incoming datagram is received based on the address and port sent out, then the NAT will translate that back into the original source and port number. Okay, so as we see here, we have a NAT and we have a number of end users. Connected to that NAT, and the NAT has its own addressing scheme, so there's an addressing scheme just within the end users. So you see, we have sort of dummy IP addresses for each of them. Okay. And so the source is based on that dummy IP address. And so if the user is sending out a packet, it will use that source address and port number. The NAT then will provide a translation service And so it will give its own IP address and a new port number, and it will link the two sets of IP addresses and port numbers within the table. Okay, and again, when anybody who's responding would respond using the source IP address and port number, so it will turn that into the destination IP address and port number, and when it reaches the NAT will make the translation and route it back to the user. Okay. So, the use of NATs is widespread, and again, it allows for sharing of IP numbers. It's not strictly within the layering scheme in the sense that it works as a router, but it relies on port numbers as well as IP addresses, and that's in the next layer up, the transport layer. It also violates the end-to-end services agreement in the sense that, well, it can be shown that applications need to know whether NATs are being used or not to run properly. For instance, peer-to-peer applications. We won't give an example, but it does. There are problems using NATs. Okay, and everybody says, well, you know, we have this new protocol, then we should use it. Okay, so one of the, again, it's difficult. The upgrade is difficult, and so even now and for the foreseeable future, we will have both addressing schemes running, and so in order to make this work, basically one IP datagram is going to have to be carried as payload in another IP datagram. Okay, so if you have a network which is running, or if you have a network which is just running IPv6, and then at some point you hit IPv4 equipment, then essentially you're going to have to package the IPv6 packet up into an IPv4 packet and send it along that component. And so again, you're going to have to, so routing will have to encompass getting from one end to the next. Okay. So, that was a fairly fast tour of some of the highlights of the sort of more practical issues to accomplishing routing, to accomplish the addressing and routing within the network. Okay, so moving on then to the transport layer. Again, in the context of TCP and IP, we have two possibilities for transporting data, not machine to machine, but process to process, program to program. Okay. And those two possibilities are UDP and TCP. UDP gives us a best effort packet delivery protocol. So essentially the applications have to create packets, address them themselves, and send them. And they will either get to the destination or not. Or TCP is our other option, which will provide a in-order data streaming service, in-order reliable data streaming service. So we'll start with UDP. Okay, and UDP provides a connectionless transport service, and it extends the IP host-to-host delivery service into a process-to-process communication service. Okay, and so we can have multiple applications running on a single host, and we will identify each of those applications or each of the connections through a port number. Okay, and so we saw the port number when we were talking about NATs. And so here we see where it enters in. Okay, processes are then uniquely addressed by the port number IP address pair. And common services are available as well-known port numbers on each host. So DNS, HTTP, the mail protocols will all have specific port numbers associated with them in the RFCs, and you won't use those port numbers for anything else. UDP does very little besides attempting to deliver a packet of data. It does provide error detections via a CRC checksum. So, the header provides port addresses, a length information, and a checksum information. Now, that gives us, again, a very simple service. It's not, but it makes no guarantees about the correctness of the data, whether if you have a stream of data, whether it'll be delivered in order or anything else. So, TCP provides a connection-oriented data delivery service. So TCP is concerned with the delivery, end-to-end delivery of byte streams. And again, it has to do this over the IP layer. So at some point, the bytes have to be packaged up into packets. But again, that's all that is concealed from the user. The user is just able to send bytes in and out of the connection. In order to track the bytes and do what it needs to do, every data in the stream is given a sequence number to indicate its position within the stream, and that's the number is based on bytes of data. Okay. So it doesn't matter how you chop it up, how you chop the stream up. You just you know where the data is within that stream. Okay. TCP is provides reliable delivery of the data and in order delivery of the data. Okay, so in order to do this, we still have to. The end users are just seeing this stream of data. So you can write data in as much as you want, and you can read it out as much as you want, and you aren't concerned with any of the details of how it's being delivered. TCP has to concern itself with those details, so TCP is going to have to cut this data up into portions and send it a portion at a time. Okay. In order to manage all of the functions within that TCP provides, we're going to need a little more information than UDP. So we have our source and destination port numbers. We have sequence numbers, so which byte of data are we sending. We have acknowledgement numbers now, so we need to know if the data actually arrived or not. So like with the data link layer and doing error control, we need to have some signaling which indicates whether our data has arrived or not. So we're just going to acknowledge sequence numbers for the data. We have a header length. We have a number of control messages which are concerned with setting up the connection. Also, like the data link layer, a lot of our flow and error control is going to be based on windows and window sizes, so we will we explicitly advertise how much data we're willing to receive at any given time. We have a checksum to check the correctness of our data, and urgent pointers just they're not typically used, so we won't go into detail on them. Okay. So TCP requires a connection, and the connection is a handshaking protocol which establishes that we can have a connection and tells us how to start our sequence numbers. Okay, so host one is requesting a connection, and it says where it's going to start sending, at what number it's going to start sending data. And then host two can acknowledge that and say, well, and since it's a two-way connection, where it will start sending data. So typically, so it says this is, we're starting at X. So host two would say, well, then I expect the next, the ACK is what I expect next. So it expects the next X plus one piece of data. Similarly, if the host two starts at Y, then the acknowledgement is that we expect Y plus one. Okay, and if the host makes simultaneous attempts, then we can use the acknowledgments and the sequence numbers to arrive at a single connection. Okay. So the way TCP works is that it buffers data from the sending information and then sends the buffered data according to, again, the TCP protocol, which is going to take into account how much data the receiver can handle at any given point, and other functions as well, having to do with congestion control. So it's a window-based system, and so the receiver, the flow control is implemented by having the receiver advertise a window size. So that's the amount of data that it believes that it can handle. Okay. And so the sender can only send up to the receiver's advertised window size in terms of unacknowledged data. Okay. So as we see with the sender, there's an amount of data buffered, and so the sender can only send again. The receiver's advertised window worth of data before it needs more data to be acknowledged, and it might have data to send beyond that. Okay. At the receiving end, the data will be reordered, so typically the data might be sent in multiple packets, so we will reorder the data. Data received in order can be sent back, will be sent, or can be received by the application. So the application will pull the data sort of in its own time. And if the data is received out of order, signaling can be done to try it'll be buffered and gaps will be filled, and if that's taking too long, then signaling will be done to indicate to the sender that there's an issue. Okay. So, we can see how this works here. The application writes 2K to the TCP sending buffer, and that can be sent on to the receiver, which will have at this moment a 4K buffer. Okay, so when it receives 2K, then it will have half the space left. Okay, so it can acknowledge that. So acknowledge by indicating what the next byte it expects is, and it will also advertise its maximum window size, so the maximum amount of data it can receive, which in this case is the 2K. Okay. So the application can write another 2K, which will be sent on by TCP, which will fill the buffer. And so you'll indicate that there's now a received window size of 0, so it's unable to receive any more data. It's when the receiver when the receiving application pulls data from the buffer, that will free up space, and you can again acknowledge that. And more data can be sent. Now, the receiver needs to be somewhat careful about its advertised window sizes and sort of how much data it's requesting. And so as a rule, the receiver should not send a window update until it has room for a maximum size segment, or its buffer is half empty, whichever of those two things is smaller. Okay. If it advertises too small a window, then you're having a lot of overhead for the actual amount of data sent. And we'll see that here. So a receiver's buffer is full. A receiving application reads a very small thing, one byte of the data, so we'd have room for one more byte. If we send that information to the sender, then the sender might be tempted to send one byte of data. And so, again, it's a very inefficient way of transmitting information. Your header information will be much greater than the amount of data you're sending. So again, you want to be able to send at least a reasonable portion of information. Okay. So, window management is it's really a form of flow control, where now flow is dependent on how fast flow is dependent on how fast the receiver process is processing the data from the TCP buffers. TCP also has a form of, sort of error control, congestion control, and it's a way of dealing with packet loss. So we, as I said, we have we have to deal with errors in the packets or loss of packets, and so we do that in an ARQ scheme, something like a selective repeat scheme. Okay, so to start with, we'll assume that the ARQ works in the way that we would think, that packets have timers or messages have timers associated with them, and when the timeout occurs, we assume that the information was lost. Now, at the data link layer, that we assume that that loss is occurring due to transmission error, so corruption in the packet. Now we're assuming that the loss is due to congestion. Okay, so it's due to buffer overflow at one of the routers. Okay. So we're going to want to have some way of dealing with that. If we get an acknowledgement, again, we can assume that everything worked correctly, and so we can send more data into the network without adding to the problems. Okay. And so what we want to do is somehow decide how much data we can safely send into the network, and this decision is sort of separate from what the end user says they can take, but rather sort of trying to infer the state of the network and how much data the network can take. Okay, so the sender has some fairly limited mechanisms. Namely, it just judges by whether it's getting acknowledgments or not. Well, essentially, when it sends packets into the network, are they getting acknowledged or not? And so it tries to use that information plus sort of just trial and error almost to determine how much information it can send. So the sender sends the minimum of what the receiver and the network can take. So to start out with, the sender starts by the sender tracks how much information it's willing, it will send in any given point of time using a congestion window, and it starts with the congestion window being 1 MSS, so 1 maximum segment size. Okay. And what it would like to do is it would like to keep sending a bit more data and a bit more data, and hope that everything's all right. Potentially at some point, if it sends too much data, it'll be contributing to the congestion, and so it will have to adjust the amount of data it's sending downwards, and then again try and slowly move it upwards again. Okay, so in terms of increasing the amount of data that we send, we have two policies. The first one, slow start, actually means trying to ramp up to a reasonable amount of data being sent relatively quickly. So each time we receive an ACK in time, we double the amount of data we send. So from 1 MSS, we go to 2 MSSs. From 2, we go to 4. From 4, we go to 8. Okay. So the congestion window then grows exponentially until a timeout occurs or the receiver's advertised window is reached. Okay. So that's good, except after a while we're really, when we start doubling and doubling, we're really vastly increasing the amount of data we send. And so what we do to moderate that is we add a threshold value, and we allow a slow start to work up until we hit our threshold value. Then we get a bit more conservative and we just increase our congestion window by 1 each time. Okay, so you want to sort of get up to a reasonable amount of data sent quickly, but after that you want to be more cautious in increasing your window size. Okay, so that tells us how to increase. Then decrease occurs if we encounter problems. So the worst problem we can encounter is a timeout. So again, we assume that if we have a timeout, then it's because of congestion. And so in the case of a timeout, we halve our threshold value. We reset our congestion window to 1 MSS, and then we go into slow start again. We keep exponentially increasing our value then until we hit the threshold. Okay. After the threshold, again, we increase by 1 each time. Okay. So what a timeout indicates is that nothing's getting through, so no acknowledgments are getting through at all, not even sort of one saying that the data hasn't reached me. A second mechanism for inferring congestion is what's called the triple duplicate acknowledgement. And in this case, if the sender is missing a piece of data, Well, it's going to periodically send, or sorry, if the receiver is missing a piece of data, it's periodically going to send the sender an acknowledgement or a piece of feedback saying, I'm still expecting that piece of data. So if you have a gap, for instance, in your data, the receiver will keep sending an acknowledgement for the missing piece. Okay. If three acknowledgements are received for the same packet, so I'm still missing this, not packets, segment, I'm still missing this data, I'm still missing this data, I'm still missing this data, then we assume that there's congestion because that's why the data is lost. We assume the data is lost and it's because of congestion. But it's a somewhat lighter form of congestion than the timeout is indicating, because obviously we are at least getting our acknowledgments through. Okay. So we say what we decide is that we don't have to scale back quite as much. We still reset our threshold value to half what it was before, but now we set our congestion window to the threshold value and from there start increasing by 1 MSS at a time. Okay. So we have a few examples of this. So here, the receiver's advertised window is 64 kilobits, and the threshold value is 32 kilobits. And so we start out at sending 1 MSS, and then we keep doubling and doubling until we hit our threshold of 32. After that, we increase by 1 each time. On transition 13, we have a timeout, so we drop our MSS to 1 again, and then halve our threshold, make our threshold value half the congestion window. So the congestion window was 40, so our threshold becomes 20, and we start slow start again till we hit our threshold of 20, and then we go up by 1. Okay. If instead of encountering a timeout, we detect a triple duplicate act, we will again set our threshold value to 20, but now we will start going up by 1 each time. So finally, note that, whoops, I think I lost something. Okay, no, I guess I didn't. Finally, note that in addition to the congestion control, we also have to deal with the receiver's advertised window size. So here we start with the receiver's advertised window being 36 kilobytes, excuse me. So as before, we go into slow start until we hit our threshold of 32. We then go up by 1 until we reach the advertised window size, and then we're only going to send the advertised window size. And everything occurs within that as before. Now, Again, we're at our max of 36, so our threshold gets halved down to 18 when we encounter a timeout and we go into slow start. Finally, at transmission 23, the receiver has changed their new advertised window size, so they've reduced it. So no matter what, the network thinks in terms of congestion, we have to send what the receiver thinks it's able for. Okay, so we see how we've got, again, the mechanisms for increasing for decreasing, and which will account for flow control. And also then finally we have to also increasing, decreasing account for congestion within the network and trying to manage congestion within the network. Then we also have the flow control with the receiver's advertised window. So one question is, how do we choose timeout values? Okay, and if you think back to the data link layer, we chose it so that we could transmit the process the data, transmit it, process it some more, and transmit it back. And the problem with the internet is that the travel time now is unpredictable. Okay, so you're not just going over a link and you have a pretty good idea of how much time that ought to take. You're going from node to node to node. Yeah, you might be going halfway around the world. You might just be going next door. Okay. So, what we want to do is to try and estimate how long this is going to take. Okay. And use the estimate to then arrive at a timeout value. Now the problem is a sort of the longer you make the timeout value, the slower you react to problems. But if you make the timeout value too short, you're not going to have time for the acknowledgement to arrive before you retransmit. Okay. So what we try to do is we try to estimate the round trip time through the network and so whenever we receive an acknowledgement, we use that acknowledgement to update our estimate of round trip time, and we do that using what's called a weighted moving average. Okay, and what this does is includes a history of the samples, and in such a way that you sort of smooth out quick variations in the time. Okay. You also take a measure of the variation in the estimates. And so that D is, it gives us sort of a variation of the estimates. And again, that's done in a, using a weighted moving average. And so, again, if you just used your estimate, half the time, you know, some of the time you're going to just naturally be greater than that. So you want to add in some estimation of how much they vary, and the measure of how much they vary is delay, which is D. Sorry, it's not delay, it's just D, which is, again, a measure of how far the samples are from the estimated values. And then, just to give ourselves a cushion, we multiply that variance by 4. Okay, so that's the basic idea for how you would choose a timeout to try and make it as small as possible while still encompassing most of the successful transmissions. Okay, so those are the major components of the TCP protocol, and so again, the big features are, from the user point of view, the in order correct delivery of data, and then in addition, it's got these mechanisms to try to manage congestion within the network. So just one final point to mention is the idea of fairness. So one way you could try and manage congestion is just by, if the networks are congested, well, you could just sort of tell some users not to send at all. But what TCP tries to do is to allocate roughly the same amount of network resources to all of the users. Okay. And so we're just going to look at a quick example of how that give us some intuition of how that works. Okay. And so here we have two TCP connections which are traveling through a bottleneck router with capacity R. And what we're going to see is that they will get roughly the same amount of, they will end up getting the same amount of bandwidth. Okay. So we're going to ignore the slow start portion and assume that we have additive increase. And so that means that no matter where, so we have our two users starting sending at a certain rate. So we see it here. And then if we assume additive increase, then they're increasing along this line. Okay. Now at some point, again, since we've exceeded the capacity of our router, we're going to hit congestion. And when we do, we're going to halve the amount of data we're sending. Okay. So we see we go in towards the origin now. We then go up in our straight line, and when we hit congestion, we again go in towards the origin, up in our straight line, in towards the origin. And so we zigzag back and forth, and we arrive at a point where the two connections are getting an equal share of the bandwidth. Okay, so this is a quick intuitive example of why TCP imposes some fairness within the resource allocation. Now, again, it's possible to get around this by opening multiple TCP, for any end users to open multiple TCP connections, and you know, you get your proportion for each connection you open. So that's it for our discussion of the internet, you know, namely TCP/IP protocols. And so again, in terms of IP specifically, we looked at, we'd already discussed routing possibilities and how routing algorithms were implemented. So we looked at additional features having to do primarily with addressing. And we saw that it got, yeah, there was a lot of mechanism and work done that needed to be done just for the addressing schemes to work. And then we looked at very quickly at the transport layer and our two possible modes of transport using UDP, which allows is unreliable data protocol, so allows it's a best effort packet delivery service versus TCP, which is a byte stream delivery service and guarantees in order correct arrival of the data, and so with the attendant mechanisms that are required to make that work. And in addition to that, imposes some ideas of congestion control in order to try and take into account the state of the underlying delivery network. So that's again a very quick overview of some of the highlights of network protocols. So we saw some of the sort of theoretical mechanisms over which the protocols are built. And so next we're going to move on to the topic of, again, how do we study the functioning of these protocols? And we'll start out by looking at, we'll have a quick review of probability theory and just, you know, again, to get some basic definitions down, and then talk about how you can build simulation models and extract meaningful information out of simulation models. So that's what we'll be doing in the upcoming lectures.